The J-Talk Podcast.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. After having to discuss the upheaval at Urawa on last week's episode, I expected a more run-of-the-mill pod this time around, only for the JFA to one-up Reds with some bombshell news breaking on Sunday night that national team boss Vahid Halilhodžić had been sacked. That obviously dominated the headlines on Monday morning, as you'd expect. And in a press conference on Monday afternoon, JFA President Kozo Tashima confirmed those reports and announced that Akira Nishino will take over as manager of the Samurai Blue for the World Cup, which, if you haven't realised, kicks off in about 2 months' time. To discuss all of that, I think our heads are still spinning, but we'll do our best to do it. It's my pleasure to welcome Sam Robson from Football Radar and our Reds correspondent and football coach Ryan Steele back to the podcast. Firstly, Sam, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, and thanks for having me back.
Not at all. Always a pleasure, of course, Sam. And Ryan, your first appearance on the reincarnated J-Talk. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Ben. It's a very exciting time for me, as I'm sure you can understand, but also to be back on the pod.
Well, it's great to have you back. And yes, you're cock-a-hoop, I imagine, after Reds' first win of the new J1 season over the weekend. And yeah, I was expecting that would be our lead topic, Ryan, when I asked you on over the weekend. And then, what's happened here on Sunday night? As I said, basically the JFA have one-upped Reds. It's the very definition of hold my beer, I would say. Reds sending a shockwave through the Japanese football community last week and very much one-upped by the JFA on Sunday night and indeed Monday. Your two cents on all of this. Obviously, we'll get into the timing. We'll get into why it's happened now. Your initial reaction and as you begin to process the news?
Just the timing of it is probably the biggest thing and the biggest talking point for most people because, as you said early on, two months out, it's definitely a shock to the system for the players, I'm sure. I think we had my Yoshida speak up earlier today about it as well. I don't know if you have the quote on you.
I don't, but yes, you're right. He definitely indicated his surprise and amazement, I think, yes.
Yeah. To be honest, I mean, they apparently it was all said and done on the weekend on Saturday, I believe. Halilhodžić was informed that he wasn't going to be taking Japan to the World Cup. So, to us, it all seems pretty fresh, but they've had a few days to mull over it and kind of work out exactly how they're going to go ahead. And to them, it must seem like the right decision. But to us, I don't think there's been a lot of questions in terms of exactly why it's come now and why it's come so late in the grand scheme of things. And also just how they're going to go forward from here, because they've only appointed someone until the end of the World Cup, and whether they've really planned things out. They've really thought things out the way that they want to make sure that that things are secure for beyond just the World Cup. You know, they've got the Asian Cup coming up soon, and we want to see a Japan that's really competitive, and not just making jerk reactions like we feel it has been for this.
Indeed, yes, Sam. I mean, yeah, I think the timing is obviously the most curious part of this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Japan officially qualified for the World Cup back in September. There had obviously been rumours flying around that Halilhodžić was going to leave his post not long after that. And, you know, surely, I mean, these last two friendly results, the performances were fairly flat. I think the consensus was the games against Mali and Ukraine that were in Belgium very recently. But for those to be the straws, if you like, that broke the camel's back, it's just basically unfathomable, isn't it? Just, 2 months out from the tournament. I mean, I don't think expectations were especially high about how Japan were going to get on, but I don't think that changes today with the appointment of Nishino either, does it?
No, I agree. I don't understand the timing at all. I don't think those friendlies can have had too much impact just on the results alone, because if it was on results alone, that result against Korea in that East Asian Championship, that should have been the final bell for Halle Hodgetts then. I wonder, the only thought I have is maybe the players have got like had far too much of his like training regime, the way, how he pushes them, the kind of negativity that he sort of brings around the team. But then with Yoshida coming out and saying it's a bit of a shock, that kind of put that to bed a little bit. It's just, yeah, very odd timing. And I think if you've stuck with him as long as they have up until 2 months out from the tournament, I think personally that he would be the best man to go into that tournament, because you're going to have a new manager come in, he'll have to have his new fresh ideas, and maybe Halle Hodgetts is not the prettiest way he was getting Japan through the qualifying, but his sort of kind of bit more negative, bit more rigid way of playing on the counter-attack, I think that's arguably a better ploy going through a World Cup group than maybe a traditional kind of more fancy Japanese style of football. So I think it has a, it could unsettle the team, but if there are these issues within the camp, maybe it brings them all together. I mean, it's definitely going to be good news for the likes of Shinji Kagawa, Shinji Okazaki, Keisuke Honda, because it looked like maybe one, two of those were going to miss out. I imagine now that they'll be lent on a bit more by Nishino, and yeah, it could gel them together, but I think it's a very odd, the timing of it is really odd, and it could potentially derail what any chances that Japan had in this World Cup, which was slim anyway.
Indeed. I mean, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, Ryan, the first thing you mentioned there was Yoshida's comments on Twitter, and Sam, you just referenced them yourself. And before I go any further, I have to give a massive shout out to Dan Olowitz and Ben Mabley for their outstanding work at tweeting, basically live tweeting, pretty much everything that Tashima was saying as the press conference rolled on. The one thing about Yoshida, though, is that he obviously wasn't in the Japan squad that played recently in Belgium. He was injured, of course. He'd been out of action for Southampton for a while before just recently making his return over the weekend, I think it was. So he wasn't there, but, I mean, if there were these, this sudden breakdown between Halle Hodgetts and certain members of the squad, Tashima referenced in the press conference that he'd spoken to one or two players. He didn't obviously name names, but it wouldn't take too much deducing, I wouldn't say, to perhaps piece together a group of, three or four senior players who have been regulars in the national squad for the last few years to work out who might be voicing concerns about Halle Hodgetts. But, I mean, if this was suddenly kicking off in Belgium, you would imagine that Yoshida would have heard about it, and the fact that this announcement's come down last night and today as we record on Monday night Japan time, it wouldn't have taken him as much by surprise, perhaps, but it seems like it certainly has. So, I mean, you can talk about the timing, and obviously that is the most stunning part of this. I mean, Sam, you talked there about the way that Halle Hodgetts would have taken Japan to the World Cup. And Ryan, as you are obviously a student of the game, a licensed coach, I mean, do you kind of share Sam's outlook there that Halle Hodgetts would have been the best man to take this specific group of players to Russia?
Well, I mean, all the what ifs and could haves and everything else it's all hypothetical until you actually get there, and Halle Hodgetts won't. So the only thing we can look at is how they were performing and whether they were on a particular trend or anything like that, how they fared against opponents of a similar ilk. And I mean, the recent performances and also some of the things that were said in the press conference today, that he had lost the dressing room in the camp and all that sort of stuff, I think would suggest that it might not have been the best experience for Japan at the World Cup under him. However, having said that, I think Sam was right in that being more conservative, as they have been in the past in some more successful campaigns, and the one that comes to mind is the 2010 World Cup. being a slightly conservative might not be the right word, but the style that they supposedly want to play, the Japanese way as they've put it, or the way that Akira Nishino has played with the teams that he's coached in the past. I think that the comparison of the two, Halil Hodžić might have had more success with the right players in the squad, but again, would he have the right players to make those selections and to have that success that he'd be after and that obviously the JFA want, even if it's a slightly better performance, as they said in the press conference. Those are the big questions, and you know, without trying to make assumptions of a hypothetical situation, I mean, the only thing we can do is look at how Nishino is going to prepare for the World Cup and the selections he makes and the style of play that he does play in the preparation matches that they have leading up to the tournament in that camp, and you know, gauge it from there. The comparison between the two will only be clear at that point, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I asked if he was the right man to take this squad to the World Cup. Obviously, he would be because he's coached them for the last 3 years and, you know, brought a lot of them through himself. But yes, as you say, it will be interesting to see what Nishino does in terms of selection. And Sam's right. I think it certainly would be a boost for the World Cup prospects of the likes of Okazaki and Kagawa. Especially, well, he certainly wasn't a media darling, was he, Mr. Halil Hodžić? And speaking of Dan Orlowitz, he won't have to sit through any more of those meandering press conferences where Halil Hodžić takes 2.5 hours to reveal his squad of 23 players, or indeed giving the media a lecture on a certain PSG versus Bayern Munich match. But with the decision made, Sam, there were three names thrust straight into the running, three rumoured candidates, and all currently working under the JFA umbrella, of course. Makoto Tegaramori, I think a lot of us feared that he would get the job, and nothing personal against him, but yes, certainly his... you know, his resume basically to me is the 2012 season with Sendai, and he's basically lived off that for the best part of the last 6 years. But, you know, fair play to him, and he's gotten where he has off of that. He was, of course, working as an assistant under Halil Hodžić, and whether that has ultimately counted against him, I guess we'll never find out. The other two names were, of course, Nishino, who has gotten the job today, and Hajime Moriyasu, who, of course, left Hiroshima and is currently in charge of getting Japan ready for the 2020 Olympics. So, Sam, did they get it right out of those three candidates, do you think, taking all of the factors, or as many as you'd like to, into account?
Well, I know you're probably devastated that Tegaramori hasn't got the job, but I don't think there was too much to choose between Nishino and Moriyasu. I don't think they could have gone too wrong either way. Nishino, of course, has got a great record at Gamba Osaka. He knows the system. He knows the players. I think he'll do as good a job as anyone. I personally would have gone Moriyasu, with just my own personal preference. I think he's worked in club football a lot more recently. He knows... maybe knows more of the players a little bit more intimately. Mm. And I think given that there's the 2020 Olympics in 2 years and the pressure that he's going to be under as the Olympic manager in that, I thought this could be a perfect opportunity to give him some like big tournament experience. Like there's nothing bigger than a World Cup. And for him to sort of work in that environment, I think that would be really good for him, a really good preparation ahead of the Olympics, which is going to be so important to Japan, of course, a home Olympics. And, yeah, I thought, because he's had such good success and with limited resources, probably as some Fretcher Hiroshima, I think that would be fair to say. And I think he would have been my pick, but I've got no qualms with Nishino taking over. I think just as a short-term appointment, I think, yeah, you can't go too wrong with him.
Fair enough. Ryan, what do you think?
I mean, the options were largely underwhelming for me. As you know, I don't think it would have been expected to be any different under any other circumstances, considering how late or how close we are to the World Cup at this point in time. But I mean, having having Nishino in the position that he's been in for the last, is it just over a year now, or a year and a half, or he's seen all the players and he's worked closely with the national team up to this point, so he's probably the most comfortable walking into that position. And being only a short-term appointment for him, I think the pressure is off. You know, he'll as soon as the tournament's over, he'll walk back to his regular seat, and when they appoint their new coach, the pressure is on that person instead. So, in terms of those things, or those things considered, I think of the three, he's probably the best appointment. You know, Taguro Mori is probably, I mean, as you said it best, that he, he's been kind of riding off the back of one or two good performances some time ago. And, you know, because people haven't forgotten them, which at the same time, we're now going into press conferences talking about the miracle of Miami because of Nishino. So nothing's really different in that respect. It's hard to really say any one of them would have been better, simply because it's not going to be an easy job for any of them. And it's more about who's more confident in managing a group of people. And I think Nishino might actually be better at that, to be honest.
Yes, well, we've mentioned his excellent record at Gunbro Osaka, of course. He managed Kashua Reysol before moving to Gunba, where he won the G1 title and the Asian Champions League, amongst other trophies, in a pretty glittering career in the black and blue half of Osaka. He then moved on to Kobe and Nagoya, where things certainly did not go as smoothly, and his tenures ended fairly abruptly. And I think actually it's kind of must be some sort of record. I think the three clubs, the last three clubs he managed, weren't they all relegated the season or the season after he left? I think it's you don't want to
say, yeah, not far off.
Yeah, you don't want to say he left things in complete disarray, but it certainly sounds like that. But apart from Gunba, most famously, of course, Ryan's just mentioned the Miami miracle, the miracle of Miami in 1996 when he was in charge of the Japan Olympic team. The win over Brazil, of course, in Miami has gone down in the Japanese football folklore. And, we'll have to wait and see if he can pull any sort of a miracle like that off again in Russia. But he's just got, as we've said numerous times, just 2 months now to try and mould a squad with no more friendlies left until basically 3 weeks before the tournament starts. So, guys, we've mentioned some names already that might come back into the frame. Of course, Honda did play in both games in Belgium, but he'd been on the outer for a while before that. So Okazaki, Kagawa, other names that definitely will be in the frame, you would imagine, fitness permitting. Sam, do you want to... I can't imagine he's going to go full retro and plump for Yuji Nakazawa or anything like that at centre-back. He could probably do a lot worse. But, another name or two that you think could be in Nishino's frame, and maybe a couple of the younger guys who might be living on borrowed time, perhaps. I'm not asking you to name a World Cup 23, of course, but, just spitballing some names here.
I'd like to see Yoshuke Kashiwagi come back in, because he was in there at the start for Halle Hodzic and then he dropped him out. I think that's a little unfair. I think he's, for me, he's the best central midfielder in the J-League, and I don't really know why he didn't get much of a go with Halil Hodzic. I'd like to see Kiyotake come back. I know he's had his injury problems, but then he was left out a couple of squads by Halil Hodzic. I thought he was their best player in the qualifying, at least the second qualifying phase, or the final qualifying phase. So I'd like to see those two back in. I'd be interested to see if Ideguchi stays in. He was obviously a favourite of Halil Hodzic, but then he's not really been playing for Cultural Leonessa. I don't know if he'll really be trusted by Nishino. Same maybe with Takuma Asano, again another favourite under Halil Hodzic. It'd be interesting, again, because he had his like core players. He liked Yuya Osaka, he liked Yuya Kubo, and as they benefited from Honda not being fancied, sometimes Kagawa and Okazaki as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they fare going into this World Cup, because I don't know if he just goes a little bit more back to basics, picks like the kind of tried and trusted players, that I think that could be the way to go.
All right, fair enough. Ryan, yeah, pretty much a question without notice. I didn't prep you for this, but yeah, any sort of names you think might be in the frame or might be edged out of the frame with the appointment of Nishino?
I mean, the thing is with Nishino, he's relied on some of the older players in the past, so I don't think too much of the old guard, as I guess they'd be called, are going to really be shifted out. So, you know, we'll expect to see similar names in the midfield and maybe even some of the defenders as well. The things that I'm kind of wondering if would change, maybe a goalkeeper. You know, we've got a few coming up in the J League. Some of the younger ones, that are, you know, starting to really put their mark on the league over the last few seasons, not just recently. You know, players like, Nakamura, is a name that I think is on most minds when we talk about J League goalkeepers. And you know, in terms of how he's supported, I mean, the thing is, Nishino knows the J League probably is as good as any other coach in the league, through experience and just being around for so long. So being able to pick the talent would be his best strength. And I don't know, so someone like this is complete, just a complete out of left field sort of name and just more to spark conversation than anything. Yeah, but, you know, players like, Kengo Nakamura, who's been absolutely fantastic for so long, and he is an aging player, so I have no doubt that Akira Nishino wouldn't be adverse to selecting him. But if he's able to maintain some sort of form, then you know the question is why wouldn't he be selected? You know, over other players, even if it's just to create that depth in the team, because depth I think has been one of the weakest points for Japan in the past, and to have strong players to be able to come off the bench, not just start, is one of the things that would really help them in this tournament and even beyond, just being able to plant that seed of not just having your best 11, but also your best 14, 15, 16 available to you is always something that a coach should really have up their sleeve.
Well, yeah, don't stop with Kengo Nakamura, Ryan. If you're going to name an experienced central midfielder, you'd have to plump for Yasuhito Endo, surely a fixture of the Gumba Empire under Nishino, of course. And I'm sure he's already sounded out to Yato to see if he wouldn't mind a brief sojourn to Russia in mid to late June. What do you think, Sam? Well, I mentioned Nakazawa. I think, I've gone a little bit too old there, perhaps. But your Kengos, obviously, I'm tongue in cheek with Endo there. But I mean, yeah, Kengo. People have been saying that he should never have been frozen out in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, ordinarily, I'd say don't stay away from your 36, 37 year olds when you're picking a World Cup squad. But if you're going to pick anyone, I'd pick Kengo Nakamura. I think he's still one of the best players, if not the best player in the league. He still can control a game, maybe not to the pace that he may be used to, but I think you can do a lot worse than Nakamura, especially if there's some sort of fractured dressing room. Maybe there were Halle Hodgett supporters, you never know. So he could help bring that together. I think an old head, can be very useful. Just trying to think of any other sort of names that could come in, any sort of... I mean, you could do worse than Nakazawa. He's played very well the last two or three seasons, even I think he's 40 now, which is be a strange selection maybe, but you could do worse than them sort of like controlling defender, because the Japan, of course, the defence is not great. It needs some sort of organisation. I don't think it's the worst idea in the world.
Well, it sounds like it might be Dad's army for Japan here in Russia. All of these young guys that Halilhodžić have brought through are just going to be given the flick by the sounds of it. But we'll certainly wait and see. I'm sure, there will definitely be a few left field selections from Nishino, young and old, and we'll find out about it. Of course, I think at the end of May is the deadline for squad selections, and the day before that is when Japan play their farewell game before departing for Europe. They play at the Nissan Stadium in Yokohama against Ghana on the 30th of May, then face Switzerland and Paraguay, both of those friendlies in Switzerland in their final pre-World Cup friendlies in early June. I think it's the 8th and the 12th, before facing Colombia in their Group H opener on the 19th. Then it's Senegal on the 24th and Poland to finish Group H play on the 28th. So, yes, Mr. Nishino, he's got 2 months to plan. He's only got three games to work his players through. So, yes, he's got a lot of work to do. Once again, to Dan Orlowitz and Ben Mabley, tremendous work on the tweeting. The situation as it went down in Tokyo on Monday afternoon, tremendous work by both of those guys. All right, I think the three of us probably need a minute to clear our heads, so I'll play a quick sting of music before we come back to talk about what went on over the weekend in J1 Match Day 6. We're back to discuss J1 Match Day 6, and on Saturday, Urawa Reds got their first victory of the new-ish J1 season, a 1-0 at home over Sendai, thanks to Shinzo Kuroki's excellent goal in just the fifth minute. Ryan, yes, I asked you on initially to get your thoughts on the club's decision to remove Takafumi Hori from his post and appoint Tsuyoshi Otsuki in an interim capacity. So before we get into the events on the pitch at Saitama Stadium on Saturday and how happy you were to get Reds' first victory of the season under your belt, so what did you make of the decision to remove Mr. Hori just five games into the new campaign?
I mean, it was a bit bizarre, but I guess we could see it coming after the club had released a statement during the international break apologising to fans for the performances to start the season, and promising that things would be better after the break. And obviously with a poor performance to resume the league, it was inevitable that he was going to go, because the pressure was clearly on, and you could see that in Hori's face after the match, after the loss, that it just, things just weren't right for him at the club. And I don't know if that was a personal thing or if it was just so much pressure and stress, or whether the players weren't really on his side, which is such a weird thing to say after what happened in the Asian Champions League last year. It was also somewhat telling that the league season last year just really petered out for the club, and the performances towards the end were just really, really poor, and the results were following that same trend as well. So for him to go, I mean, I think the pressure was on from the very start for him. The expectation to really push on in the league without the distraction of the Champions League would have been the real importance for the club, for the board, and the technical direction of the club. They really want to focus on continuing winning trophies, not just have it a 10-year trend. And it was, it all happened pretty quickly after the break. And that's I think that's where most of the shock comes from, because there was such a big space between two games when nothing happened, and then what it seemed like it was one loss and he was gone. But it was definitely a build up to that point, and that was just the straw that broke the camel's back, really.
Yeah, what did you think, Sam? I mean, obviously, Horty's come in, replaced such a fixture of the club in Miša Petrović. He's gone and won the ACL in his first full season, and then five games into the new campaign, two draws and three losses, and he's out the door. But I guess this whole losing the dressing room thing is very much a real thing, because it's just happened to Halil Hodžić as well. So that's two in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I feel sorry for him. I mean, to go and win the Champions League after taking over from Petrović, who had Urawa playing in such a, like a 3-6-1, that was how Urawa played. And he had to come in and try and change that, because it wasn't working. He tried to move to this 4-1-4-1, which worked really well in the Champions League. I mean, they were a lot more defensive, a lot tighter. They could sit back and they could hit on the counter-attack and they could sneak 1-0s or whatnot against the likes of Shanghai and Al-Hilal in the final. But I think he came a little bit unstuck in the league. I mean, the league performances were poor, especially this season, I think, because that formation didn't allow Urawa to attack as, like, the fluidity that they were used to. It leaves Kuroki completely isolated for long periods, because before you'd have Muto and Lee in behind, the interchange there worked perfectly. Without that, when you're trying to put Muto out to a left wing position, which I don't think he's particularly comfortable with, the right wing options of Martinez didn't really work. Takatomi, I think, is better centrally as well. I think that was maybe his main downfall, the change of formation and the inability in the January window to kind of get players to fit that system, because the players still really are built for this 3-6-1. And you're playing Endo out to the right back, he's not particularly comfortable there. You're playing at left back, you're either moving Makino across, this doesn't particularly work. Kikuchi the same, Ugajin the same. It's the team doesn't really fit this sort of style he wanted to play. And I don't think it was this sort of brand of football that Urawa need to play, especially when you're playing Nagasaki, for example. No disrespect to Nagasaki, but you shouldn't really be playing with, like, as defensive as they were, really, the 4-1-4-1. No one was really getting into support Kuroki. I think that was his downfall. Again, harsh on him to be five games after winning the Champions League. But I think the change had to be made, and they have. I think, as we saw in the first half, especially at the weekend, they looked a lot freer. They looked to be enjoying the system a lot more, enjoying the football more, and I think it's the right decision in the end.
Okay, that's really interesting to hear you say that, Sam. Yeah, I was going to ask you, because obviously you have to watch every J-League game every weekend for your job. So I was going to ask you whether there was such a noticeable difference between, well, obviously, the way Reds finished the last J1 campaign wasn't great, as you both mentioned. But, yeah, I mean, did you notice a drop-off even from that to the first five games of this season? I mean, it certainly sounds like you did, because it was the right time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily in terms of the league performance. I mean, it was kind of master league performance last season by the success in the Champions League. If you just ignored the Champions League, which is always difficult to do, they were still playing pretty poorly. And I think if there wasn't the Champions League, he'd have been gone at the end of the season. Because it worked against, like, Shanghai and Al-Hilal. I don't think it was too harsh in saying that they were better teams than, they have better footballers than Urawa in those games. Urawa came in as underdogs, and if you put the men behind the ball and counter, I think that's the perfect way to play against those. But when you come into the J-League, you're playing against teams that Urawa expected to go out and attack, expected to beat comfortably. Like last season, they beat Vegalta Sendai 7-0. They were, like, absolutely rampant, and that's not going to happen with the way that he was set up. It was a little too cautious, and because Urawa are not brilliant defensively, if you get at Urawa, they are going to fall apart a little bit. Nishikawa is prone to an error. Makino, Mauricio, Abe dropping back there, they're not particularly great defensively. So if you're inviting pressure from any team, even if it's Nagasaki, they're going to score a goal against them. And I think they just need to push forward a little bit more. I mean, not to the extent that Petrović was doing, where he was leaving one man at the back. But I think that balance kind of needs to be found, and he was too far the other way for me.
All right, and you said, Sam, that they were, it seemed to play with more freedom on Saturday. And, Ryan, it didn't take long for the new man, Mr. Ortsky, to pump his fist in delight at a first league goal under his watch. It took only 5 minutes, a lovely through ball from Yuki Muto, and Shinzo Kuroki did the rest once again against Sendai.
Yeah, and it was a fantastic goal from Kuroki. I mean, the pass to him was great, but he still had a whole lot of work to do. And, you know, he ends up beating two players, one of them being the goalkeeper, Seki. And it was a return to form, essentially, for him, which we hadn't seen, you know, unbelievably. It was only his second goal of the season. It just was a sign that they're a lot more lively now. They're a lot more in tune and responsive to what's happening with the team, with the club, with obviously the coach, because the change came in response to that. And it's just, I mean, to have it happen so early in the game was really a huge indicator, and I think even the players responded to that goal alone. Just kind of, it was more like a confirmation for them that what they were doing now, as opposed to before, was a lot more positive and was working out a lot better for them as well.
And Sam, it's an absolutely a phenomenal record that Kuroki has against Sendai. I have to give credit to the DAZN J1 All Goals show for this stat. He's played 17 games in total against Sendai. Sam has Shinzo Kuroki, and that was his 17th goal against Vegalta. He has absolutely phenomenal record. The Vegalta killer, I believe they call him, or certainly the Sendai supporters would certainly know Kuroki as that. And if he can hit some form, that's goals in two straight games, as I think Ryan mentioned there. And if he hits some form, then that could be a catalyst for Reds pushing up the table. And notable that it was Muto laying on the assist. So hopefully good signs for Mr. Otsky's reign continues.
Yeah, I mean, it's vital to Urawa that Kuroki play as well and scores goals, because besides Kuroki, you've got Zlatan, who's, you know, is not great anymore. Lee's a bit past it as well. So it's vital that he is there. It's vital that he strikes up that partnership again with Muto, which showed signs at the weekend. Hopefully for Urawa that can continue. And I think Takatomi will help as well. I really like Takatomi at Kashiwa Reysol. He plays in that little pocket, similar to where Muto does. I think those three can have a really good combination going forward. And, yeah, I think that result gives Urawa confidence. I think it was a little bit more of a test in the second half. I think Vegalta played pretty well. But to get through that, to have the confidence of Kuroki on the score sheet, a win under the belts, I think Urawa can now look to move forward. And hopefully for them, they'll move up the table pretty quickly.
Yes, well, one of the few teams that didn't make that much of a jump, actually, with the win in match day six, so moving from second from bottom all the way up to third from bottom 16th, but now on 5 points from six games, and things looking slightly rosier, as we've mentioned. A couple of games coming up, and we'll get to those when we talk about the upcoming fixtures. Of course, there is a midweek round of J1 that has certainly snuck up on me. I'm sure Sam is well and truly prepared, as I said earlier. He has to watch every single game, every match day. But before we move on to the other games from the weekend, Ryan, I better get your thoughts on a certain Mr. Andrew Nabbitt. I don't even know if I pronounced that right, because I don't know very much at all about our fellow Australian who has joined Reds this season. He's come off the bench in the last two league games. So what have you seen from him? What was your reaction to his move in the first place? And then how do you think he's settled in based on how he's gone in his first two league appearances? And I think he's played in the Levain Cup as well, hasn't he?
He started in the last match against Sanfrecce Hiroshima. It's funny that you mention not knowing how to say his name, because I'm starting to have doubts as well now that the way that they're writing it in Japan is very different to how we've been saying it in the A-League. Everyone was saying Nabbitt, and now in Japanese it's Nabout. So having some second thoughts, I'd like him to address that. So Andrew, if you're watching or if you're listening, then feel free to get in touch with the pod or myself or anybody, or just make a video. Just let somebody know how you actually say your name so that we can get all of this cleared up. In terms of him as a player, he's newly capped with the Socceroos. So his international experience up to this point, up until the last international break, was essentially lacking. But in the A-League, where he really came into his own with Newcastle Jets. He's a very powerful striker. He likes to use his strength and his pace to charge behind defenses and create his own scoring opportunities. He's got a powerful strike behind him as well. If you look at some of the highlights of him in the last year and a bit of time with Newcastle in the A-League, some of the goals he scored were absolutely phenomenal, and I have no doubt that that those goals were the things that really tipped Urawa over the edge in terms of deciding to sign him. But going on to him as a new signing for the club, I was honestly surprised that he was on the radar. I assume it's because of the departure of one of the most key players that we had last season, as I'm sure you're able to guess who I'm talking about. Sam, can you help him?
No.
No? The player that went to China quite recently, just before the start. Yes.
Miles away. Let's cut that out.
We've already forgotten about him, so obviously it's a good sign that he's gone.
You've got a bit edited out. What do you think?
I don't know, keep the mess in, who knows?
At least it makes me feel better about myself.
I don't know what you're talking about,
so obviously his departure heading off to China just before the season started meant that Urawa were desperate to find someone to fill his shoes, because I think they were looking for him to partner up with Martinez on either side of the flanks and the two of them causing havoc in attack, which was probably Horry's plan in the first place. So I can kind of see why they rushed out to sign another attacking player. I was still surprised, because I thought that we might have enough depth, given some of the other signings. As Sam mentioned, Takatomi is one of those players that is definitely someone I consider a player that would be able to fill those shoes. Maybe not exactly to the same ilk, but at least enough to cover that spot until the club has had enough time to kind of source a reasonable list of suitable options. And that's not a slight on Andrew, but I'm sure that the club would have liked to have not jumped to quickly signing somebody new under such extreme circumstances. Having said that, since he's been at the club, he's shown that he wants to fight. He had an article with, I think it's Player's Eye, which is a player written, article or player article written, website where players, talk about their experiences as players and the life of a player, and, his experiences having had issues at Melbourne Victory with selections and being out of favour with the coach, and moving to Malaysia and having troubles there and facing depression and struggling to find a new club. And then when he got that opportunity with the Jets, he worked really hard. He was absolutely determined to to fight for a spot and prove his worth as a footballer, not just as a player with the Jets, but just as a footballer to make sure that he had a career because he felt like he didn't have any other options. It showed that the moment he stepped on the pitch that's continued with the club. And those were the sorts of things that I was hoping to see out of him, especially given how much of a surprise it was to me, as I'd mentioned. And for him to have shown that in the few games that he's played so far, are extremely positive signs. And hopefully, as he does get more game time, he adjusts more to the team, and you know, he starts to understand the style of play that they want to play a lot better, as I'm sure a lot of the players will have to under a new coach as well. I'm actually now looking forward to seeing how he performs with Urawa going forward because, as I said, very promising signs.
Yeah, terrific. And it obviously seems like he settled in very, very quickly. You would have to say he's already moved ahead of both Tadanari Lee and Zlatan Ljubičanić in the pecking order as he's come off the bench before Lee in the game before last and then, got through nearly half an hour on Saturday with Lee remaining on the bench. And in the last two league games, Zlatan has not even been in the squad. And that could be injury-related, I'm not sure. But, so interesting to see how our friend Andrew, we won't butcher the pronunciation of his family name anymore, gets on. It seems like he's adjusting well, and hopefully that will continue. Okay, now we've obviously got 8 games left to review, and I'm going to throw a question without notice at both of you. And Sam, unfortunately, you've drawn the short straw. You get to go first. I'm going to ask you to name, as I did with John and Stuart on the recent J2 special, I'm going to ask you to name a surprise team and a disappointment for you so far through 6 games. And that will basically shape where our review of Matchday 6 goes next. So apologies. Well, of course, you can choose Urawa as a disappointment and Sendai as a surprise if you like. But in the interest of the podcast moving forward, I hope you would choose 2 other teams. So I'm asking you to shape where we go next on our review. So why don't you give us a surprising team for you in a good way, of course, so far through 6 games, and we'll talk about their result on the weekend after that.
Okay, well, it's a little difficult with like the 3 points separating 2nd and 14th. I mean, it's difficult to say anyone's really struggling or anyone's really underachieving there.
Work with me.
Yeah, I'm going to go for Shimizu S-Pulse. Even though last couple of games have been not as great as they have been, I really like the way Jan Janssen has set up the team. He's taken the kind of big decision to drop Jon Tesse. And Chris Lang came in, who got like strangely limited game time at Vegalta Sendai last season. And they've just looked a really good, positive side. I mean, the work between the likes of Kitagawa, Kaneko, Mitchell, Duke, and then Chris Lang, they've been a really good attacking side. I remember the game against Sapporo at the Sapporo Dome, where Sapporo went 1-0 up. And the second half, they were absolutely obliterated by Shimizu. They just got a really well-balanced side. Because I, now stupidly, I think, predicted them to be one of the teams that could be getting relegated this season. But they've seemed to have shored up their defence. They've got Hwang Seok-ho, who used to play for, was it Kashima Antlers a couple of seasons ago? He's alongside that Ferrer, who didn't really settle in last season, but looks a solid partnership in front of Rokitan in midfield. They just look a really well-balanced side in their kind of 4-4-2 formation. And, yeah, I'd say they're my surprise package. I mean, yeah, even against Jubilo, I think they were arguably the better side. It was quite a tight game in the Shizuoka derby, but, yeah, they've really impressed me so far.
Okay, let's move on to talk about that game then. Feel free to fill me in because I wasn't even able to see any highlights of that. It finished 0-0 at the Akorpus Stadium. A very healthy crowd made it out to the middle of nowhere in the Shizuoka countryside, over 30,000, which is a good attendance. I guess not that surprising for a Shizuoka derby, but yes, it ended goalless, but you were still impressed with Shimizu?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great attendance for first and foremost. I don't know really why Jubilo... I know it's great for their coffers, I suppose, to get 30,000 in at the Acopa Stadium, but you lose that home advantage, I feel, and especially at the Yamaha. I'd have thought that would have been really crucial to them against Espos, but even so, it was not the greatest game of football. I mean, both teams... It was full of passion. There were a lot of like tackles flying. It was proper derby. A bit too many crosses going in. It wasn't a vintage Espos performance, which is unfortunate given I've just beat them up. But yeah, they still caused a few problems for them. Chris Lann, I really like Chris Lann. I don't know why he wasn't playing regularly for Vegalta last season. He is an absolute handful. He's really great in the air. He's got chest control. He's then great with his feet as well. He scores some incredible goals. This game, again, as I say, not the greatest example, unfortunately. But they got kind of a mixture to their game. They really, like, they've got the technical football. Like, Kaneko is so little... So quick. He had this one shot and maybe like 15, 20 minutes in, takes it about 25 yards from goal, shifts it out of his feet quickly, fires it against the post. It was a great effort. But they've got those sort of players, a little in-between players, and then they've got the brawn of Chris Lann and the defenders. They've got a great mixture. And, I mean, there's no chance for me. I mean, it's probably too early to say, but I think there's no chance that they're getting relegated. I think they're in for a pretty successful season.
All right, fair enough. And very topical you mentioned, Shimizu. I do believe that Barry Velder has made his triumphant return to the country today, Monday, for a short trip. That will include, Shimizu's trip to Saitama Stadium to play Urawa this coming weekend. So welcome back, Barry. And I did try to get him on next week's pod, but apparently he's going to be flat out and understandable, of course. He'll have loads of people to catch up with. But, great to have him back in the country. And he'll be very happy to hear, I'm sure, Sam's big raps on his S-Pulse voice. All right, Sam, I'll give you a little break here and I'll turn to Ryan. I'm sure you've been thinking while Sam's been speaking about his pick of S-Pulse there, Mr. Steele. So which way are you going for your surprise team through six games of the new season?
I'm actually going to go with Consadole Sapporo. Mm-hmm. How well their strike force has been doing, and you know, the weekend's game against Nagoya was just epitomized that, or just completely reflected that, the 3-0 result against Nagoya, and how well the players have just gelled together, and especially under the new coach Misha Petrovic, and just how that's really worked for them over the few months that he's had there since he left Urawa.
Yeah, fantastic. And a goal of the season contender from Ken Tokura in the 69th minute to score Consadole's second goal. A dinked cross to the back post from Jay Bothroyd, who was back on the bench on Saturday after missing out in the previous game. Good to see Jay back and making a contribution. Good to see Bothroyd and Tokura linking up, of course, because in the first few games of the season, as I mentioned to Jay when he was on the pod, it was one or the other, and it was Jay, obviously, in the first three or four games of the season. But yes, they combined, and Tokura powered in a superb bicycle kick at the back post. That made it 2-0, as I mentioned. The first goal came off the head of Ryosuke Shindo in the 26th minute, and then a fantastic finish, it must be said, for Sapporo's third. Unfortunately for Grampus, it came from their defender, Kazuki Kushibiki, a tremendous own goal, and a Sapporo dominating the shot count in this game, 23-7, and most importantly, of course, the goal count, 3-0. And Sam, do you share Ryan's raps for Consadole? Of course, they made a massive leap in the table on the weekend, rising from 15th all the way up to 7th with this one victory. It speaks to the tightness of the table, as you did earlier. But, yes, Sapporo, wouldn't say defying expectations, because they did so well towards the end of last season, did they? So just carrying on where they left off, if you like.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Ryan was saying. When I was on the pod the first time, they just lost the opening game against Sanfrecce Hiroshima, but I still saw good signs from Sapporo, and now they've had a bit more time to gel under the new manager. They seem to know his system. I think they look a really good prospect. I'm amazed, really, at how they've been fairly decent defensively, because Petrovic, I imagine, just would go in there, they'd go all guns blaze, and it'd be exciting to watch, but they might struggle at the back. But I think, looking at on paper, you've got Ryosuke Shindo, you've got Kim Min-tae, and you've got Fukumori. So, on paper, that doesn't look like the most solid of defences. But I think Shindo especially has been incredible this season. Young defender, I know he got his goal at the weekend, but I mean, he seems to have commanded that back line. Like last season they had Yokoyama, the kind of more elder statesman signed from Omiya, who's been dropped completely. And Shindo's taken up the mantle. They look fairly well organised. And then going forward, when you've got Bothroyd, and as I mentioned last time I was on, Chanatip and Miyoshi in behind, they're so quick. A nightmare for defenders to try and track their runs all over the place. Bothroyd himself will move out. And I agree with you that I think Tokara and Bothroyd work well together, because Bothroyd, as he would say himself, is not just an aerial presence. He is really good on his feet. His ball in was superb for Tokara. His goal was fantastic. Langerak's goalkeeping maybe not as fantastic. But yeah, I think there's so much good going on for Sapporo. A really exciting team to watch.
All right, terrific.
Just to add on to that, sorry. If anyone has a chance, there's a video on the J League YouTube channel. They've been regularly uploading videos of all the Thai players. And there's one from this game of Chanatip, and it's just all the involvements of Chanatip, whether he's basically in the frame or whether he's actually on the ball, and just watching his movement and the way he's involved in helping set up both Jay and Ken is absolutely fantastic. I know he's had an extra year to settle in into the league compared to the other Thai players, but just seeing what he's been capable of since his arrival, and especially this year, is just shows how promising it is for the other players that have come in to the other teams this season.
All right, terrific. Nice heads up there from Ryan, so head to the official J League YouTube page for that. I'm not sure if it's probably geo-blocked here in Japan, Ryan, but international listeners can certainly check that out. And yeah, Chanatip continues to do well for Sapporo, which is a terrific to see, of course. All right, let's flip it back to Sam. All right, you can define this any way you like, Sam. So who's your disappointment through six games? And again, Urawa's not out of the picture if you wanted to plump for them, but I'll leave it to you.
No, go not on, with that. I won't not plump Urawa. Not while Ryan's here, no. That would be unnecessary. Absolutely unnecessary. I mean, I could move away. Well, Nagoya are my pick. I don't really want to keep going on about the Sapporo-Nagoya game, but I mean, given the build that they were given, when you've got when you sign the likes of Joe, and everyone was expecting Nagoya could push for a top three, top four finish, and it's just not happened. I mean, Joe has been so disappointed. The first game, I thought there was a decent bit of link-up play. Gabriel Xavier is their best player by a country mile, and you could tell against Sapporo, with him not playing, they offered nothing. And Joe, I don't know if it's just not really that bothered, but he looks quite languid. I mean, he doesn't really get involved with play, he just kind of wanders around. His finishing is not great. He scored the one goal against Gamba Osaka, but in subsequent games, he has missed pretty simple chances. I mean, he's disappointed me. And then there are always going to be a shambles at the back. They were, like, if you can see four goals to Ehime FC in J2, you're not going to do very well in J1. And I mean, I know it was the Levain Cup, but to concede four goals to Shun Nagasawa is perhaps the most embarrassing statistic any defence can ever have.
That's remarkable, and yeah.
They just look a mess. They look an absolute mess. I mean, they've got three good players. If you include Langerak, you've got Xavier, and you've got Joe. Joe hasn't turned up. Langerak has been pretty decent, other than the goal against Tokara. But besides that, Aoki's okay. Hasegawa, I mean, just ask Steve Barn for his opinion on Hasegawa. And they surprised me. They came in with all these expectations, and they're looking like they're probably going to be down there again unless they can sort things out. I know there are murmurings that fans are unhappy with Kazama, which I think is a little premature. But yeah, they've been pretty dire, especially defensively.
Well, you talk about Hasegawa. There's a laundry list of people you could talk to about Arya Yoshida Hasegawa, including myself. Of course, he's spent a couple of years with FC Tokyo in inglorious circumstances. And, yeah, I can't imagine who would have tipped Nagoya to finish in the top four. It's absolutely a ludicrous suggestion. As they sit down in 15th in the table, they basically did the opposite of Sapporo. They almost swapped places. Sapporo rose from 15th to 7th, and Nagoya dropped from 8th to 15th on the back of a 1-3-0 result. So, they started in a blaze of glory, of course, Grampus, with two straight wins, and since then they have not won a draw and then three losses on the spin. Perhaps it is best we move away from that game now. I think we've kicked Nagoya while they're down enough. So, Ryan, I'll throw it back to you for your disappointment through six games.
We probably should go with Gumbo Osaka, really. The last of the main J1 teams that still hasn't had a win.
Absolutely, yes. They're sitting rock bottom with just a point from six games. They've been unfortunate in certain games. They've fought back from 2-0 down to draw with Kashiwa. They fought back from 2-0 down. Ultimately, lost, of course, 3-2 to FC Tokyo. But they've shown some fight. And in the Hanshin Derby, I believe it's called, down that way, on Sunday, they looked like they were going to end the game at home against Kobe with a point, only for Shuhei Otsuki to slot past Masaaki Higashiguchi after fine work down the right from Sou Fujitani. So, yes, Ryan, it has been a very difficult start to the season for Gumba under new manager Levir Kulpi. I'm sure you've watched this game, so Gumba are unfortunate to throw away their point right at the death, but when things are going bad, they tend to snowball, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the worst performance from Gumba. I don't think it was fantastic by any stretch of the imagination. I think it was a pretty even game. I thought 0-0 would probably a fair result in that one. They were unfortunate to concede. But, yeah, I mean, it happens that, are they 16 league games now without
that
a victory?
Correct.
I mean, if you're on that sort of run, you're not going to get the luck that you need to get out of this. I mean, it's a difficult one. He's playing these young players. I don't know if that's the way to get out of it when your team is maybe a little spark, but it's not like they have a golden generation there or anything that's going to lift them out. I mean, Ryotaro Machino came in for his debut at the weekend. He looked okay, but I don't think he was ever likely to score or make anything happen, to be honest. I think then another problem they're going to have is because in the Levain Cup, just to try and get some victories, to try and get some confidence, they've just played the same team. And when you're playing pretty much midweek, every week until the World Cup, they're going to burn out, especially when you're playing Yasuhito Endo at 38 every game. I don't really see too much positivity to get out of their situation at the moment. And I mean, there's all the old adage, are they too good to go down? But I mean, if you don't win in 16 games, no, you're not very good. And they could be the latest in a long line of big names to go down.
Absolutely. For the second time, obviously, in the last 7 or 8 years. All right, before we move off Gumba, Ryan, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the appointment of Levir Kulpi. I spoke to Alan Gibson about it last week, and of course, Alan was positive because he's a positive guy and he supports Gumba and he wants them to do well, and he didn't seem to have too many problems with the club's decision to appoint Kulpi, who is, of course, a former two-time manager of Cerezo Osaka. So let me ask you, as a Reds fan, how would you feel if the permanent replacement for Takafumi Hori was Zdenko Verdenik?
I heard what Alan had to say about Levir Kulpi's appointment from the last time he was on, and I think it would depend on what they were trying to achieve with the appointment, and I can see that they want to get back to the kind of football that they'd been playing in that kind of golden period around the 2007, 2008, 2009 sort of era. and when they won the Champions League, obviously, in 2008. And that's they're showing signs of that capability, that they are playing that sort of thing. They had a couple of chances that if they actually had a player that was actually on form, able to actually finish a chance, then they would have been 1-2 goals up, and it wouldn't have been the result that we've had, and we might not even be talking about them the same way that we are right now. I'm sure that the Gumba player, the Gumba supporters, they're not too happy about it at this point, because of the results, purely because of that. So, Cerezo fans definitely wouldn't be happy either, because, it's their old boss. It was the one that they actually really enjoyed their football under. They had great players. It was kind of a special time for them as well. So if it was under those circumstances, I could understand completely why fans wouldn't be too happy. And as Alan had mentioned, people accusing him of being a sleeper agent of sorts. I don't think I can agree with that either, like Alan had said. Just because it was purely because they weren't able to finish chances on the weekend that leaves them still where they are right now. And if they are able to come into form in the next few weeks, it would be absolutely incredible, and I'm sure the relief from most Gumba fans would start to wash over them. But as Sam said, with so many games coming up before the World Cup, and the way that they're being played, the amount of youth and the amount of inexperience in the team, is really looking bleak for them at this point.
Absolutely. All right. And for new listeners to the pod, or those not familiar with the history of Omiya Adija, Zdenko Verdenik is a Slovenian who came in to manage Omiya in the 2012 season, and basically turned into the Slovenian witch doctor of Saitama. He turned the Squirrels into a winning machine towards the end of 2012. Saw them escape relegation. They started the 2013 season like a literal house on fire, and topping the table before ultimately dying a fairly ordinary death. And Mr. Verdenik was relieved of his duties in the same season, where he saw his team top of the table in controversial circumstances. So, Ryan, not addressing there whether how you would feel if Mr. Verdenik...
No, well, to be honest, if you'd asked whether Urawa had signed Lucas Neal, I might say something completely different.
Okay, fair enough then. All right then. Okay, so yes, Gumba, would be my choice as well for a disappointment through 6 weeks. But yes, as we've seen in this last match day, a win or two in a row can see you make some decent progress up the table. And Gumba have been close in recent weeks. It's got to turn sooner rather than later, and it might even come as early as this Wednesday. All right, gentlemen, we've still got quite a few games to get through, so we'll do so fairly sharpish. We've mentioned two of the three main derbies that were played over the weekend, of course, the Shimizu and the Hanshin. The other was the Kanagawa derby at Nissan Stadium, Yokohama hosting Kawasaki. That finished 1-1, both goals going in off opponents' faces. The first was credited to Akihiro Iyanaga, but is another example of the J-League's frankly stupid own goal rule. The ball was cleanly struck by Iyanaga. It hit Yokohama keeper Hiroki Ikura, bounced off Ikura onto the post, bounced off the post onto Ikura's face, and then went into the goal. Anywhere else in the world, that is an own goal, but it's gone down as an Iyanaga goal. I'm sure he gets a healthy goal bonus, so he will not be complaining. That to put Kawasaki into the lead in the 58th minute, and came after good work from Ryota Oshima and Hiroyuki Abe. But just 3 minutes later, the previously mentioned Yuji Nakazawa, now in line for a return to the Japan national team, of course, ahead of the Russian World Cup at the ripe old age of 40, headed home, and he was right to get credit for this goal, as the ball was on target before it hit El Seno in the face, which completely wrong-footed his goalkeeper, Jung Sung Ryong. So, Sam, a brief word about this game, which also featured the return to Nissan Stadium of Manabu Saito. But for the F Maranos faithful, a bittersweet day as it came in a Kawasaki uniform.
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrific game of football, first and foremost. Like, end-to-end stuff. Like, Kawasaki, I think they should have had, like, three or four goals in the first half, and just their finishing let them down. And the spectacle was added by Manabu Saito. I don't recall too many more toxic receptions to a player coming off the bench than Manabu Saito got. Just booed completely. I mean, he played... He was brought some energy to the Kawasaki team. I think he'll be an incredible signing for them, which Marinos might not be too delighted by. He would just get the ball, he'd take on his man. It didn't necessarily work for him, but it was definitely an impetus. But, yeah, as I say, brilliant game of football. Not necessarily from a technical standpoint. I think both teams gave the ball away a bit too much, but, I mean, it was great for a neutral. And Yokohama, they've just been starting to play pretty decent football under Postecoglou. It's seems to be working a lot more now. I was a bit critical last time I was on the pod about the way they were playing and Yukura and their defender a little bit, but they played a lot better. They rode their luck in the first half, Kawasaki. And maybe because Yuko Bayashi wasn't in the squad, Yoshino Okubo was on the bench, so Keiichi Nem was up front, not the most clinical of finishers, and that probably cost Kawasaki the game. But it was a really good, feisty derby, and yeah, one of the best games I've seen this season, to be honest.
All right, terrific. And before we move off it, Sam, sorry, Ryan, I just want to get Sam's thoughts on Olivier Boumal. You will have seen him in action in both of Yokohama's last two league games. Sean Galbraith mentioned him a couple of weeks ago, of course, and he came straight into the squad and straight into the 11 for the last league game. Got through an hour, and he got through 72 minutes on Sunday before being replaced by Keita Endo. So what have you made of him through two games?
Yeah, I'm pretty impressed by him. I think he's still lacking match fitness, so that's why he can't get through games at the moment. But he's kind of a big beast of a winger, like a really powerful winger. He gets involved with the play. He's maybe still lacking a little bit of the, not necessarily intelligence, but like the kind of understanding with Hugo Vieira and then Matsubara coming in behind him. I think that's still got still to work on, the bit of the communication difficulties. But he's got all the physical components to be a really good, strong, wide player. I'm pretty impressed with him, considering he's had limited time with the squad, especially when they're all getting used to a new way of playing. But he seems to have bought into it. Postecoglou's shown faith in him with the first two games. And I think, yeah, that front three, when it all clicks together with Vieira, Boumale and Yun Il-Lok, I think that's a pretty decent front three, and I'm fairly impressed with him so far.
All right, terrific stuff. Okay, we've made it through all this time, but we haven't mentioned the team who is now 5 points clear at the top of the table. That is the Sanfrecce Hiroshima under fantastic manager Hiroshi Jofuku, who might have been a bolter for the Japan national team job at the moment, but I imagine Sanfrecce would not want to let him go, as he, as I say, led Hiroshima to the top of the league. And Ryan, they... Basically, every win they've gotten so far has been a surprise to me, because I wasn't expecting anything at all for them after they narrowly escaped the relegation in 2017. But yes, this latest one was a character-building 1-0 win away at Kashiwa, thanks to a goal from Sho Sasaki. Hiroshima, very economical in this game. They only took three shots. One of them went in, and they returned to Hiroshima with 3 points.
Yeah, I mean, it was first of all, it was an incredible strike to get that goal. But what they've been doing right this season is just making the most of opportunities and capitalizing on the other team's mistakes. Kashiwa Reysol did have a penalty that was given to them, and Cristiano that took it. And you know, it wasn't the best penalty, but it was still a very good save to keep it out and keep them in the lead as well. They're playing really, really open this season, which, you know, you would expect the goals to come at the opposite end, but they've only conceded, I think, one in these six games in the league so far. And that's just absolutely incredible. I don't think anybody would have said that. Even the most diehard Sanfrecce fan probably wouldn't say that they'd be at the top of the table undefeated with only one goal conceded so far after six games. That's, that's just a huge thing. But they're extremely open, but in defense, they're just doing just enough individually in most of the cases to keep the ball away from players to create chances. And that's what's really doing them the job at the moment. It's not so much the attacking prowess, but just that defense and keeping it tight keeping it secure individually at the back, man marking and keeping everything close together, is really working for them. And obviously the results have gone to show that.
Indeed. All right. Well, yes, Hiroshima having conceded just one goal through six games, it would definitely be a surprise to everybody if you'd said that at the start of the season. I tell you what's even more surprising is that FC Tokyo would be the league's highest scorers after six games. But that is in fact the case. At Tokyo, the only team to have hit double digits in goals so far. And they got half of them away at Nagasaki on Sunday. Indeed, this J1 match, they featured a total of 21 goals, and a third of them came down in Kyushu at Nagasaki. FC Tokyo winning 5-2. You know I love a stat, guys. The first time Tokyo scored five in J1 in 4.5 years. The last time was in September 2013, and they won by the same scoreline at Omiya. Diego Oliveira scored a hat-trick for Tokyo. That is Tokyo's first J1 hat-trick since Ryoichi Maeda did the same in matchday 27 of 2015. That was at home against Kobe. Not a lot to say positively, at least, about Nagasaki's defending in this game. But, this is famous last words. As soon as I start to feel even slightly positive about Tokyo, I know everything is going to collapse in a heap. But it's three straight wins, the Gasmen up to fourth, and as I say, the highest scorers in the league, although scoring five in a game will do that for you. Nagasaki slipped below Reds, now second from bottom, with just Gamba below them. I don't know what to think about this, Sam, but it's three straight wins, and they've defeated a very poor Nagasaki side, it must be said. But on the other hand, it's very unusual, as I've just laid out with the stats, for Tokyo to properly put a team to the sword, but they have done just that.
Yeah, I think must be the first time I've appeared on the pod and been positive about FC Tokyo. I think it was obviously aided by some pretty woeful play from Nagasaki, but I think that they found a balance now, Tokyo. I think Diego Oliveira has come into his own. He was always good at Kashiwa, but had Cristiano around him and Ramon Lopez, a lot of good players there, but he's now taken the mantle of Tokyo. And I think the decision to take out Ryoichi Maeda and put Kensuke Nagai up front with him, I think that has worked perfectly, because he can run off him. He gives a bit of space, because Maeda will just stand there, pretty much take up the same space that Diego Oliveira wanted, and now he's got that freedom. He's a very good goal scorer. He took his goals very well at the weekend. I mean, Keigo Higashi is playing well and getting on the score sheet, so I'm not really sure what's going on there.
That's three league goals. That's three league goals now. That's surely going to be all he'll score all season. So he's blown his load already, and it's only six games in. But yeah, fair play.
Yeah, unbelievable. And yeah, Kotaro Omori is playing well. I think it's a nice balanced side. They look confident. I think I don't know if Morishige coming back into the back line has helped, just from a settling standpoint. Obviously, team captain, he seems to organise that side well, and then Takahashi and Hashimoto are pretty settled in that midfield. It's just, I don't want to go too early on Tokyo, but yeah, it's looking positive. Maybe move away from mid-table slightly this season.
Yeah, well, we'll wait and see. And Ryan, I don't expect you to say anything positive about FC Tokyo, so I think we'll move on. There's two games left, and they both finished two. Sorry, you didn't want to say anything positive there, did you, Ryan?
The only thing I was going to talk about was the penalty that Nagasaki gave away. For a team that I guess don't want to go down again. I mean, I would hope that's what they want. When they gave away the penalty, all 11 players were inside the penalty area, and they still let the ball go through them, and still gave away a penalty. That's just absolutely shocking, and I don't think anyone can expect anything of them given the way they've played these last six plus games, including all the cup matches. They've been scoring goals, but at what cost? You know, the defending, the ultra conservative defending that they've been implementing this season just is, first of all, not attractive. I would hate to think what the fans are thinking of these performances recently. I wouldn't like to be in their shoes, even though I was close to being in it for the first five games at least. Just the way that they've been defending. I think of any of the clubs so far, we talked about Liverpool earlier. I think Nagasaki might be the first one to have a coaching change of, by the time we reach the World Cup or just past it.
The first one, after your mob, you mean?
The first from this point onwards.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah, well, along with Gumba, the only two teams that yet to win so far. And, I wish them all the best. Obviously, it's their first ever season in J1, so I hope to get that first win under their belts fairly soon. And I'm a pessimist, so I presumed that it was going to be against Tokyo on Sunday. But that wasn't to be, of course, in Tokyo. Surging to victory against my expectations. All right, so, yes, I mentioned the two games left. Both of those ended, in 2-1 wins to the home team. Probably the biggest shock was at the BMW Stadium in Hiratsuka, where Shonan claimed all 3 points against Kashima in very dramatic circumstances. Indeed, it must be said. After the teams exchanged goals inside the first 10 minutes, Shonan first taking the lead and then being pegged back by Yuma Suzuki, thanks to a brilliant through ball from Kento Misao. Shonan won it deep into second half stoppage time, thanks to Miki Yamane, who burst from midfield after Kashima could only clear a long throw into the box. He dinked the ball past the last defender and rifled a shot across the keeper to win it and send the Hiratsuka crowd into raptures. And fair enough, too. That was a surprising result. What wasn't surprising about Cerezo 2, Tosu 1 is that we had a refereeing controversy. There seems to be one every week, at least one every week so far in this new J1 season. And this particular occasion came in the 75th minute with Cerezo 2-0 up. It should have been back to 2-1, or at least to give Tosu been given a chance to halve their deficit. A ball was chipped into the box and clearly hit the Cerezo defender Kimoto on his arm, extended out for no apparent reason, but the ref, who appeared to have a good view of it, allowed play to go on. The Tosu manager, Massimo Ficcardenti, spoke out in his post-match press conference, not only about that incident, but indeed other controversies that have dogged the new J1 season, or at least given us some stuff to talk about. So, guys, this is another red face moment for the J-League and their officiating crews. Tosu did end up halving the deficit in the 77th minute. Then, of course, they had been awarded that penalty and scored 2 minutes earlier, then it would have been 2-2. But, of course, if that had have happened, then, the whole universe spins on its axis in a different direction. But, I'll get your thoughts on the latest refereeing controversy. Sam, looked as clear as day to us.
Yeah, it looks a penalty to me. I think, I don't know what Kimoto's arm is doing now. I wouldn't say it was necessarily deliberate handball, but it was just such an odd position to have your hand, and it was just, and it hits it. I think it's got to be a penalty. I don't suppose Ficcardenti mentioned Kyosuke Tagawa's penalty in the first game, did he?
I'm not sure if that came up, actually, no.
No, just wash over that one, shall we?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Ryan, I don't know, what can you say? As a coach, I mean, 6 games into the season, it might have gotten too much for him already, even though, as Sam says, he was the beneficiary of a fairly horrendous decision in the first match day. But, yes, they just keep piling up, don't they?
So, I mean, he wasn't the only one to really be aggrieved this week, at least, because There was also a handball that you missed in the Shonan Kashima game. The Shonan winning goal should have actually been called for a handball earlier in the attack. The way he received the ball when he actually took the pass, it was on a counter attack, and probably from the referee's perspective, he saw it hit the chest, but it actually on slow motion in the replay because it was shown for some reason in the replay in the highlights. It actually hits his arm. And the Kashima defense basically stops dead in their tracks calling for it. And obviously it's not something as a team you should be doing. And I'm sure they're going to be yelled at in the dressing room for the rest of the next couple of days before this upcoming game. But that was very costly for Kashima, which should have been pulled back. And I'm sure Fikidenti, he's not going to care about what happens for the other teams. He's only going to be caring about his own team. But I think that shows it's a problem that's spread right across the league, and it's not exclusive to one team. And there's every reason to be bringing up issues with referee decisions throughout the season, because it's just been absolutely insane how many there have been, even from the slightest things. But when it's costing teams goals, and it's cost more than one team a goal in this round alone, it's something that really needs to be discussed a lot further, and then something needs to be done, whether it's further coaching education or just a lot more scrutiny in the media. I know that a lot of the a lot you've had on the pod in the last, or just this season, if not previously, they've called for more
transparency,
commentary. Yeah, well, not transparency, but just the commentators and the highlights looking over things more scrutiny. That's the word I'm looking for. Be more scrutinous towards decisions and actually looking at replays properly, and just not saying, "Oh, maybe it was offside," but actually looking at things and seeing where referees could be better might be the first step in actually improving these sorts of things.
Fair enough, but yes, it sounds like a long road to hoe in that regards, but hopefully, yes, the refs will pick up their game and we won't have too many more controversies to speak of this season, although that is wishful thinking, I would imagine. All right, I think that is all 9 games from Match Day 6 covered. As I mentioned earlier, there's a midweek round. All 18 teams play on Wednesday, the 11th of April. So that will be a very busy night for Sam. I don't know how many screens you're going to have up, Sam, and how many games you're going to be able to get through at once. But with 8 games kicking off at 7 o'clock Japan time, and just the one at 8 o'clock. It sounds like a very busy Wednesday. Well, that'll be morning for you, won't it? And afternoon. So a busy Wednesday for Sam. And then, that's a Match Day 7, of course. And then Match Day 8 takes place this coming weekend with the 5 games on Saturday and 4 on Sunday. I won't bore you with the entire fixture list, but in terms of some of the major teams we've talked about in this episode, Urawa, Ryan's team, visit Kobe on Wednesday before hosting Shimizu, which Barry Velder will be at, of course, on Sunday. Gumba Osaka have two chances to notch their first win of the season. On Wednesday, they host Iwata before a battle of the bottom in Nagasaki, 17th, currently sitting 17th, and Nagasaki host currently bottom Gamba. And leaders Hiroshima have a Kanagawa double. They host Yokohama on Wednesday before travelling to the BMW to face Shonan on Sunday afternoon. Obviously loads more games in the J1 fixture list over the coming week. Sam, how exactly will you manage that on Wednesday night Japan time, Wednesday morning UK?
Well, it's just a lot of work afterwards, because I have to kind of focus on one game, so I have to make my selection. So this week, midweek, I've got Vissel Kobe versus Urawa. So that's my focus initially, and then I just have to catch up on the rest of them as the weekends Yeah, just really busy every midweek round, just a lot of catching up to do.
Well, that's amazing. All right, well, yeah, good luck with it. Obviously, you enjoy it, otherwise you wouldn't do it. So, yeah, enjoy your feast of J1 football. I have to apologise to the listeners again for the lack of J2 and J3 coverage on this week's podcast. Sure, you can understand why with the Halil Hodžić news, of course. I hope to go some way towards rectifying that next week. But before we go, just the briefest of updates. Okayama continued to lead the way at the top of J2. They bounced back from their first defeat of the season last time out with a big 1-0 win at Niigata, and they sit 2 points clear of Oita, winners of four straight, and Yamaguchi, who also claimed a relegated side scalp in match day 8. They won 2-1 at home over Omiya. While in J3, the surprise leaders after six games are Tottori. They drew 0-0 at Fujiya on Sunday and sit a point above the other unbeaten team, Numazu, who also drew on the road 2-2 at Nagano. Okay, to Ryan and Sam, thank you both very much for appearing on the podcast again. We've kept the listeners for much longer than I anticipated, but I'm very glad we fleshed out the whole Halil Hodžić Nishino scenario in part one before giving J1 Match Day 6 as much attention as we did. So before I let you both go, please plug your Twitter accounts before I let you go. So Ryan, where can people follow you on Twitter?
On Twitter, you can find me at Stelinho, Stelinho. I tweet mostly about J-League and just Asian football in general.
And thank you very much, Ryan, for being on the podcast again. I hope to catch up with you soon.
Thank you very much. Splendid pleasure, as always.
And Sam, you'll have the last word. Where can people find you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can follow me on at FRSoccerSam. I should be live tweeting most J-League weekends and midweek rounds, so Vissel Kobe versus Urawa on Wednesday. Yeah, give me a follow. Talk to me about Japanese
terrific
football.
Terrific stuff, and great to speak to you again, Sam. I'm sure we'll catch up again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
All right, then. That is it for this week's bumper episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sam Robson and Ryan Steele, and, of course, to you for listening wherever you are. And I won't be anticipating another shell shock bombshell news of some manager getting fired. So next week's episode will probably be back to normal, as I say, hopefully with a J2 guest to boot. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Hello?
Whoa. Hello. You're in the back of a lorry or something, Sam?
I don't think so.